Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
This is Mitchell Davis, host of Taste Matters. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Chef Story. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton, and today is the most unusual day because sometimes I'm in the back of Roberta's, which is always pleasant, and sometimes I'm at the International Culinary Center, and I lure chefs there. But today I'm sitting in the middle of Central Park on a beautiful summer day with our guest, Katie Sparks. Welcome, Katie.
Hey, Dorothy. Great to have you here and great to be part of this wonderful show.
Well, everyone, I think, in New York, if not the world, has heard of Tavern on the Green. But I think almost everyone in New York is familiar with Katie Sparks, too, because she really lit up New York back in the 90s when she opened Quilties. And in 98, she was named by Food & Wine magazine as one of the rising star chefs. And that's in the days when they didn't seek to put women on the cover. She just did it on her own, you know, and she was just a chef in New York City that you could not ignore. And out of her kitchen, she really spawned not only a lot of today's chefs that are into the local movement, but chefs that adore her, you know. A lot of chefs come out of kitchens and they respect the chef and they say, I learned a lot of the chef, but there's almost a cult following. So what we want to do today, Katie, is really get into your background. You've had so many incredible journeys in your lifetime, and I think you've handled them extremely well. And so let's get into, like, what made Katie Sparks? Where did you grow up, and how did you get your first love of food?
Well, thank you for that preamble. That's lovely to hear. I grew up in Vermont, outside of Middlebury, so even smaller town than Middlebury, which is small enough. And my parents moved up there from Princeton in the mid-60s and just were completely enamored of the land. I think my father, as an academic, had a lot of different opportunities. Middlebury is trying to woo him, and it wasn't until he literally saw the land of Vermont that he was like, yes, this is going to be where we raise our kids and settle in. So that sense of place was always part of me, and we were able to raise some animals. We had grass-fed beef and chickens, and we foraged, and, you know, we had about 65-70 acres up there. And, you know, in a fertile part of the world like Vermont, that's a lot of things to eat. You know, if you are reasonably well informed, you can almost live off the land. So we did that periodically and grew a lot of vegetables, foraged for morels and ramps and all those things.
So were your parents foodies?
I would say so, although I think they would resist the term. I think that term came of age much later. They were both born in 1930. So they're kind of a funny mixture of foodie and post-war thriftiness, I would say. My mother is Scottish ancestry, so she's very thrifty, quite a thrifty lass, my mom. And my father was more prone to the extravagant gesture. So my father, if he were to ever get a windfall, the first thing he would think of is a fabulous meal, either locally, if he could get to Boston or New York, or, you know, they traveled a lot abroad, so it would be a Michelin star meal. And, you know, back then, a college professor's salary, especially in a small college town like Middlebury, was not extravagant. So he had to kind of earn it. Like every time he would sell another textbook or the new iteration of a textbook that he had already published, there'd be a little bit of cash. And that almost always went to great meals.
So being academics, did they take you to Europe? And did you have an intellectual appreciation of food as art?
I did. In fact, what I think formed me as a chef, because when I was going to culinary school, it still wasn't really a profession for, particularly for women. It wasn't necessarily a profession. You know, my brother and sister both went off to Princeton. I went to Middlebury briefly and realized I had no sense of what I wanted to do with my life, so I dropped out. And what do you do when you drop out of college? You work in a restaurant. So I was actually a hostess in a bar, and little by little, I just kept gravitating to the kitchen of whatever place I was in, if it was humble like a bar or a cafe, because of memories of being in my mom's kitchen, always the center of the house, you know, always the control center, you know, it's where the temperature gauges were and the news shows. You know, you grew up in the country, the weather is incredibly important. So mother had everything you could ever measure what's going to happen, the atmospherics and the barometric pressure. And it's like, and so it was super important to me that the kitchen felt like not only sort of the emotional center of the house where, you know, we had family meals all the time, but sort of I call it the smart center. Just that my mother's very practical and she's still up there. I just got back from visiting her. She's 84 years old. She lives on her own now. My father's passed away. And just so present, you know, present with the rhythms of life that you have to be when you're a country person.
So that must have been a shock to your parents, coming from Princeton, a Princeton academic and two siblings going off to Princeton. And this isn't in the days of celebrity chefdom. Yeah. So how did your parents support you, or what were your friends saying and your peers? And what was it that you went to Johnson & Wales, correct? And so how did that all and how were you feeling about yourself in those days?
Well, that's a very interesting question because I'm trying to reconstruct a little bit. So here I was at Middlebury floundering as a freshman, and in fact, they invited me to take some time off. And so I did. I went to Europe. My parents, in order to pay for three kids in college, although there was some, you know, definitely contribution from Middlebury, it wasn't enough, you know. So they actually felt the need to go abroad, rent their house here, you know, take a directorship of Middlebury School in Mainz, Germany, and just, you know, be there because the tax advantages were really compelling. So when I went to Middlebury, I couldn't go home. My parents had rented the house to other academics visiting. They were in Europe for 3 years, and when I was in trouble, I had really nowhere to turn to. So they believed in my strength, I think, more than I did, because they didn't dig me out of the hole. So when I went over and I studied in Vienna for a semester, and I came back, I tried Middlebury again.
What did you study?
I, you know, whatever was easy, you know, music history. And
Were you speaking German?
I was speaking German. I had done Middlebury's summer school program the summer before my freshman year. So I've been around German. That was my father's specialty. That's what he taught. But we aren't German, so we didn't speak it in the home, and my mother barely spoke it. She was more a passive sort of understander of it. But so to me, it was a tough language. I actually studied French and loved it in high school. I was going up to Middlebury College as a high school junior and senior, and you know, but German intrigued me because my father had been a Fulbright scholar in the 50s, and the Hazy family, which is sort of old aristocracy, and they had a beautiful apartment right off of Zingerstrasse, which is down from the St. Stephan's Dome, and they became family friends. So back in the 50s, their kids were small. We were a glimmer in their eye, you know, and so it wound up being that the two families kind of grew together more or less in terms of, you know, the number of kids and the age spread and all that stuff. So I had my counterpoint, Janka, who was 15 when I was 16. She came over and spent the summer with us in Middlebury, and I just loved the way she spoke. The language just was gorgeous to me, and I didn't realize that at the time that Viennese German is particularly lovely. I just love the lilt of it. It's sort of like having a Southern accent as an American. Just gorgeous. Mm. And I was intrigued enough by wanting to go visit her that I enrolled in the summer school program.
Oh.
Yeah. So
do you have a particular fondness for Schlag?
I do. Mit Schlag. Schlag Obers. I love. I was just actually doing a little TV segment a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about Speck. Because I pronounce it the German shp instead of spa. But yeah, I do. I, you know, I play with my son all the time about the German stuff, and you know, every once in a while I'll quote a Rilke poem or something, and just to make the sounds of German, because it's playful, you know. It's a kind of.
So let's get back to culinary school. So were you an aficionado of German food? Or?
No, never. Germany and German food is a I would say a subtle sort of background note to me. It's not a every once in a while I might play around with a schnitzel. I did a rabbit schnitzel at Quilty's with you know, chive and black pepper spätzle and. That kind of thing I play with, but it's what really informs my cooking is my heart's much more in the Mediterranean, I would say, either Italy, France, Northern Africa, Middle East.
So your formation as a chef, did you know any chefs in those days?
No, I didn't. This is so funny to me now. I thought about the reason I went to culinary school wasn't because I had an epiphany, wow, I want to be a chef, or even I didn't even know anything about that world, but... Our neighbors, who are part-timers, they lived in Boston. He had made some money in his life, and he had a country house in Vermont, and they lived in a nice place down in the valley from us. And he was on the board of Johnson & Wales. And so I think behind the scenes, I didn't even know it. My father and he were talking about my future, I'm sure. And I was given an invitation to be taken on a tour of Johnson & Wales in Providence by the president of the college. Like, who would say no to that, right? So my first impression of Johnson & Wales was in the back of a big car going to all the different satellites of the campus and walking in and having everyone be extraordinarily like, oh, hello and welcome and, you know, so gracious and amazing. And I thought, wow, this is nice. So my father convinced me, he said, just do something. It doesn't matter if you don't need to do this for the rest of your life, but just engage again. Because I'd been kind of going through a low period and not knowing what I wanted to do. So I was 20 at this point. And my parents were still abroad. So I enrolled. I was accepted, which doesn't surprise anyone, given, you know, the sort of connection I had. But from that moment on, I was just like everybody else. I mean, the moment I signed up and nobody cared that I knew the president of the college. I mean, and I wouldn't have ever thought to leverage anything. It was too naive, and plus it just wasn't the way I was raised. But so I was a little shocked. It was shocking. It was very hardcore. It was run sort of like a military academy. We had to wear hairnets, steel-toed shoes. We had line inspections at 6 in the morning when you went for your first rotation.
Is it still like that?
I don't know. I really don't know. But it was like that then, and it was the only campus they had, and it was extreme, and it winnowed out a ton of people just the first semester. But I thrived in that kind of structure, paradoxically for me, because I've always been a bit of a rebellious kind of person when it comes to authority. Uh-huh. So I liked the way to measure yourself. I liked that I knew the path to excel in the culinary world. It's so concrete. It wasn't politics. It wasn't really who you knew. It wasn't, you know, are you going to get tenure or not, or do people like your book or not, or your whatever that I'd seen my whole life in the academic world. I'd seen a lot of people not having their own agency and autonomy because maybe one of the couple got tenure and the other didn't, and then, you know, somebody's just drifting around, you know, not doing their life's work because they needed the financial stability that, you know, academic. And I wanted freedom from that.
Chefs are subject to that.
They are. I have found that.
Maybe in school you had that structure that let you excel that way. But you know the whims of
I know it now. I know it now.
So you went through, you graduated summa cum laude.
I did.
Yeah, you were a great student. And what was your first job at a culinary school?
It was where I did my internship, which was Al Forno. And it's funny, I was doing so well academically that they automatically partnered me at Epcot Center in, like, that was a plum, you know, that was a reward.
Down in Florida.
Down in Florida. And when I heard this, I'm like, no, this is not me. I'd already known that I was kind of a local, locavore kind of person. So I said, no. They wouldn't listen to me that was not what I wanted. So I actually had to go to the dean's office, and he said, you have 48 hours to find yourself something suitable, or this is what you're doing. And he was really kind of harsh about it.
And then Epcot was more industrial.
Yes, exactly, right. Exactly.
So why did they give the summa cum laude then?
I think they thought it was a path toward worldly exposure and maybe a power path. You know, I could okay. be an executive chef of a big thing. Yeah, you know, their frame was just different than mine. Yeah. They didn't have any classes on local food, or it was all about big facilities.
Yeah,
if you can imagine. So, to me,
so then there was the teaching. Geared to big facilities?
Yes.
So where did you... Is it El Forno that was sort of your graduate school?
El Forno was...
That's Joanne.
Yeah, and George. I had seen it by walking by their Steeple Street store, which was like 30 seats, and I love the aesthetic of it. It was painted all black. The walls, the ceiling, the floors were black. Then the tables had white tablecloths and white paper, and then... They were preset with the wine glasses with the rolled up, like horn shaped. Have you seen that napkin fold where you just roll it into a cylinder and then you put it in a U? And it was just so clean. And then with a basket of apples in the fall, red apples.
Yeah.
It was such, and they're visual artists, both of them, a photographer and a sculptor. So that was like, I love this. I want this. So I contacted them in this 48-hour window, and I told them the story. They said we don't have an internship link with Johnson & Wales. We've never taken an intern from Johnson & Wales. And I said, you know, could we talk about it? And they said, well, why don't you do a tasting for us, and we'll see. So I'm like, a tasting, okay. So, you know, I'm still a pretty...
Were you reading a lot of magazines in those days?
No, because I was so immersed in it. I was always so exhausted because I didn't have any money, so I had to work at night in a pizzeria. So I'd get up at 6, I'd go to my classes. By 3, I'd come back, and I'd do my homework assignments, and then at 6 to midnight, I was working in a pizzeria. So I was tired, you know. Yeah. I was too tired to read.
Your discretionary time was drinking wine, I'm
exactly.
Sure.
So I went to them, and I crafted a menu that now makes me laugh because it was so heavy-handed. I did a hazelnut-crusted roast, a veal roast, and I did gnocchi with gorgonzola cream sauce, some kind of chocolate mousse, I think, for dessert. Like, you know, the kind of thing that's kill you with richness. I even think the veal roast had a cream sauce to it, probably. So
what appealed to them?
It's funny. Afterward, George, who's actually quite a warm person, he came over and he took my hand in his and he said, you know, that was really terrible. Well, in a joking way. And he said, but we really liked the way you worked in the kitchen. You know, we really, you know, they were observing me doing my thing, and they said, we'd like to, you know, we'll take you on. So that was a 6-month internship that led to a job offer from them. So I stayed a full year. I stayed a full year there.
And what did you learn there?
I learned that you don't have to be a food service to run a restaurant. That they were similar to Alice Waters in the sense that they had a forager, this young woman who would be given a list of things that they needed, you know, the quahogs from the coast and the sausages from Federal Hill and the, you know, cornmeal from Gray's Grist Mill and, you know, all those things. And they would send her off in her Impala and she would load up the trunk in the back seat and bring the goods back to us because we were tiny, you know, a tiny restaurant. And I just love the immediacy. We would... You know, we grilled pizzas, and the timing of the pizza had to coincide with the spinach that I was wilting on the stove. So they used timers for everything. That was really fascinating. There's like a bank of timers, and when we got really busy, the main expediter in the center who mixed the pastas together had the mental load of timing components. So, like, I was working the ovens usually, so I had the baked pastas would go in the oven, and they were very specific about just the amount of rolling... boil of the cream sauce around the edge. Like when those bubbles are really fat and round and moving at this pace, that's when you pull it out of the oven.
Wow.
Like I love that kind of
precision
and observation, but not precise like putting an amaranth leaf on a plate with a tweezer. I hate that.
Yeah.
It's precision around observation of the lusciousness and the qualities and the qualities in sense of its intrinsic itness of food, you know, observing it, seeing that, you know, if you wilt the spinach just right here when it's glossy and it still has the leaf definition, but it's, you know, that's when you stop. You know,
right.
I really learned a lot about
that. So we're going to take a little break here and we'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Grace Bonnie, host of After the Jump. This summer, Heritage Radio Network is turning 5. Since our launch in 2009, we've continued to bring you food and culture content like nobody else. And we need your help. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a passionate, grassroots, action-oriented, nonprofit organization. That means we depend on the support from listeners like you to keep us alive. If you love what you hear on Heritage Radio Network, visit our website and become a member today. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef's Story, and today my guest is Katie Sparks, and we are sitting, you're going to hear ambient noise, and it's going to be birds chirping. We're sitting in the gorgeous garden of Tavern on the Green, the newly reopened Tavern on the Green, where Katie is the executive chef. So, Katie, we've just finished El Forno with bubbling lusciousness, and I've never heard it, you know, described so well. So, there you've got your culinary school, you got your little graduate school there. How did you go on to really take New York by storm? How did you get investors for, you were down in Soho in the most beautiful little restaurant. How did a woman in those days, when women, really, it was even hard to get a spot in a great kitchen, let alone take over a kitchen, get investors and open. Tell us that story.
Sure. I mean, from because I'd gone to Europe quite a lot as a child, I didn't have the wanderlust to go to Europe. I did have the wanderlust to go to the West Coast. And friends from Middlebury had settled in Seattle. And I'd had a fascination with the Pacific Northwest just from photo essays and magazine articles and things like that. So I went out the November after I left Providence and no money in my pockets to speak of. And really just these buddies, but no culinary context whatsoever. So I just landed, I stayed with friends, and then I started kind of learning the scene. And what I found was that I really was attracted to this woman chef named Susan Vanderbeek, who was the chef of Campania at the Inn at the Market in the Pike Place Market. So I, my timing, again, a lot of life is about timing, luck and timing, and being sort of aware that you should say yes to whatever presents itself. And they were moving. They were moving from one neighborhood down to the Inn at the Market. And you know, my resume was okay, right? I mean, El Forno had a reputation, so that was nice and solid. So one thing builds on another, really. The first decision you make, I think, is important, although not fatal if you make the wrong one by any means. So that was a good 3 years out there. I loved it. I really loved being in the market. I loved the theater of the guys throwing the huge king salmons around. I loved the roommates that I had. One of them was, I lived with a woman who was the first female longshoreman on the docks.
Really?
Yeah, she was a union chick. You know, she was hardcore. She was a red diaper baby, too. Her parents
A red diaper?
Oh, a red diaper baby is a child of American communists.
Oh.
Yes, really fascinating. Not the first red diaper. Oh, the first red diaper baby I met, but I met another one when I lived in the West Village in New York, when I first landed in New York. So wow. I'm not a communist. Let me say that clearly. No.
But you've seen red diapers.
Yeah, it was a great place to be, again, influenced by local terroir, local ingredients, people who are passionate
How
about
was
their
it
food
different
shed.
East Coast and West Coast in those days?
You
what
know,
year was this?
This was 84. 86.
86.
Yeah.
So the American Institute of Wine and Food was just revving up with conferences. And winemakers started talking to chefs and farmers were still a distant group that everyone appreciated, but weren't really chummy.
In that day, most of chefs' inspiration and influences came from Europe. So these are people like I've mentioned before, Alice Waters, who traveled abroad and learned from the more mature relationships between all those people.
Right.
So there's models out there; they just weren't here yet. And so I've been fortunate to be of a generation that has started to mature our, you know, food culture here, and not derivative, not borrowed, but just, you know, our own. And that's super exciting.
So what brought you back to the East Coast?
Family. As much as I loved it out there, and it was really gorgeous, and I just didn't like being, you know, an entire day's travel away from my family. And Vermont is stunning also. And so I came back to Vermont and I stayed there for a summer. I thought it felt longer, but it was really only a summer. And I'd become urban at that point. I just couldn't help it. I would drive 30 miles trying to get a good cup of coffee in Vermont. I just could not find one. I couldn't find anyone who would make espresso. Yeah. Or if they did, they'd put it in those pedestal cups and they'd pour whipped cream all over it and shaved chocolate and I had been in Seattle when the first Starbucks was there, so I was completely turned on by the coffee culture. I thought it was fabulous.
I want to jump to Quilties because that opened in the mid-90s, correct? And that's when you got recognized as one of the leading stars. How did you raise capital? How did you have the balls to think I can open a New York City restaurant? And where was your support system? What was it like back then? Because I think there are a lot of young chefs out there today who want to follow their dream. And I think there was a heyday where there were a lot of investors, but now with real estate, we're even seeing Union Square Cafe close. It's a huge risk. How do you garner that? And when you did it, it was equally tough. Maybe not for a male, but definitely for a female. So tell me about that.
Well, I hate to have to revise that lovely setup, but actually I wasn't an owner. I was the hired chef. There were owners. I was not one of them. And so I didn't have the burden of raising capital. I was hired, actually, Stephen Hall, who's my longtime friend and ally and publicist and all that, made the introduction through a connection at the Beard House. So the owners of Quilties had owned a Quilties in Princeton. And that's a funny kind of roundabout connection back there. But they wanted to open. They had a real estate opportunity on Prince Street between Sullivan's, the genesis of Quilties. They one of them had been a patron of the former restaurant there, an Italian restaurant, and the owner said he wanted to get out. So the place was purchased. Then they looked for a chef. And when they found me, they didn't look any further, which was very gratifying. It's like we met, we had a great instant chemistry and rapport. They didn't ask me for a tasting. They just said, you're hired, you're it.
Other than Alice Waters, who were the other female chefs at that time leading a restaurant? Because this was a huge leap. I just want to get it. This is revisionist history here that, we have a female chefs. It was huge that you got that position.
Well, there was Anne Rosen. Is it Rosenzweig?
Anne Rosenzweig at Arcadia.
At Arcadia. There were few. There were very, very few.
Very few. So was it because of Princeton they knew you? Was it family
connection? No, we didn't know each other. They were asking around at the James Beard Foundation. They thought that's a good way to find a chef.
Did they have a preference, male?
No. And the good thing is it didn't even occur to me. Having grown up on the farm and having, baled the hay and driven the tractors alongside my brother every summer, feeding the horses, I didn't really feel a gender. Work wasn't gendered to me. It just wasn't. Work was just work.
You know what I'm thinking? You did. Well, we were walking around this stunning new restaurant. If you haven't seen the new Tavern on the Green, you have to. It's so tasteful. It is so comfortable in its own skin, sitting here in the gorgeous Central Park. I think Frederick Law Olmsted would be very happy with it. Katie said to me, we do get celebrities here. Gloria Steinem was here, but I just didn't want to go up and bother her. I think she would have wanted to meet you because you were, a groundbreaker for women. So I just wanted to put that out there. But anyway, so tell me what it was like. What were the challenges in the 90s? Now you've just opened Tavern. What were the challenges in the 90s versus today? Put it in perspective for people.
I think the challenges in the 90s were, and this, of course, is hindsight, so I'm not sure how much to believe this myself. It really felt more about finding your own culinary voice, because that was really still very possible. There were not so many ways to document what people were doing as there are today with Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. And, so you could actually toil away in obscurity until your product was sort of ready, and then you could be discovered. There was a lot more time to evolve and develop and take risks and fail. All those things, I think, were important. So those were the positives. I think the negatives were you could possibly never be discovered and just toil away and, you know, feed your public, and that's fine too. But I did have a little bit of a hunger for a broader audience. I felt like, you know, food is my medium. I'm an artist. I wanted people to take notice. I wanted to participate in the life of our world, you know, our culinary world, and I wanted to be a player is wrong, because I have a lot of conflicts about how much I engage in all that stuff, but I wanted to have the option. I wanted to be able to be out there if I wanted to be.
So you had worked for Barry Wine at mm-hmm. the Vaulted Quilted Giraffe.
That's right.
And you also worked with Bobby Flay. You were the executive chef of Bolo.
Yeah.
Which was the top Spanish restaurant in New York. It was, and so these flavors from Barry being French. Here we are. New York is getting in the way. We'll be right back. There we go. Somebody, if you hear the horses in the background, the taxis, you feel like you're with us right here in New York. Anyway, so you really had worked in some of the very top and was acclaimed. I don't think I ever realized you were the chef at Bolo when it got the stars.
I was the
it
chef.
It had three stars, right?
I wasn't there then. I was there when we had two, and I was the chef de cuisine, and Bobby was always the executive chef. You know, those little nomenclature differences.
Yeah.
You know, only chefs really care about all that stuff.
Yeah,
most people, like, oh, whatever, chef is a chef. But it definitely was a hierarchical difference, and it was his cuisine, and...
Yes, I'm not taking anything away
and
from Bobby.
He's
a really good chef, and he is in his kitchen. So.
Yeah, and so that was fun and interesting, and we went on a research trip to Spain, which is a whole other conversation some other time.
So you really had great exposure.
Oh, yeah, and he was very generous. Bobby was always, as soon as he hired me to be his sous chef, as we opened Mesa Grill, he was, like, taking me to events, introducing me to the Illuminati of our industry and writers.
How many chefs were hiring female sous chefs in those days?
It was a small pool to hire from. I think it wasn't calculated. I really think it was a lot of it's my energy around. I don't feel at any disadvantage. I'm also a tall girl. You know, I'm 5'10". I'm strong. I can do the work of kitchens.
Yeah.
You know, there's no risk in hiring me.
Right.
You know,
well, I don't mean to harp on this. Yeah. We'll get off the thing. But it truly was a remarkable time. So how much of that did you bring to your own? When you sat down and said, okay, here is my cuisine. Because as we were talking, this whole farm-to-table movement or whatever it's called today, you were doing 25 years ago.
Yes.
And this, as you said, it was never a fad to you. It was a way of life.
Right.
So when you conceived the first menu at Quilty's, what was in your mind? Because here, you're finally out of the gate.
Yes.
You can do what you want.
It was thrilling and terrifying, because Bobby had been such a strong mentor to me, Bobby Flay, that when he said, you're going to have to, he saw my menu, I think I ran it by him, which was very global, all over the place. I pulled some of the Japanese stuff from the Quilted Giraffe, and I had some Southwestern allusions, although the dishes were coherently modern American, but the ingredients were sort of all over the place. And anything that intrigued me, I kind of put on the menu. And he said, you're going to have to define yourself. It's just, you know, people won't understand. So you have to choose. You know, you're going to be Italian or French or Southwestern. What are you going to, you know? And I just, you know, stubbornly refused to go there. So I put the menu out, and I think that's one of the things that surprised people, is how sort of...
Eclectic
and personal. That's a word that I heard a lot. It's a personal. My cuisine is personal. I'm not trying to cater to somebody's needs. And, you know, this is interesting. We'll circle back when we talk about the tavern menu and how that all works. It's such a big place. But, I just wanted to say, hey, this is food that's important to me. I want you to enjoy this. And I'm going to labor over the dish in a way that's both emotional and intellectual and gustatorially satisfying. I want it to be delicious and yummy, but without being infantilizing yummy. It's not, you know, it's also got, like, my oysters in a Gewürztraminer cream with mirin glazed grapes and some frizzled leeks, and I had a perfect brunoise. Actually, one of my sous chefs hired on, when he tasted that dish, he had come in as a diner. He said, the perfect brunoise just got me. I had to work here. So that was Matt Weingarten, who's now a wonderful chef in his own right. Doing what you're passionate about leads to other things you can't even imagine, because it's a direct communication with people. And most people have enough sort of, whether they think about it or not, they're moved. You know, they're moved by authenticity and passion. Rather than calculation.
And like art, they can recognize it when they see it.
Exactly.
It's very hard to give a formula for it.
Yes.
But it's instinctual. And then not everybody will like it. It's very
absolutely
personal.
Absolutely. You have to be willing. You have to be willing to weather harsh critics and people who don't get you. And maybe some of them have a very large, loud platform, you know?
Yeah.
And that's unnerving. But you have to just keep going. You know, you have to find your voice.
Who were some of your mentors? Who were some of your superstars you looked up to?
They were the chefs I worked for. They really were, because being a chef is way more than your dishes and way more than your write-ups and your stars. It's your who you are. It's how you treat people. It's the energy you emit when you're in your space. And are you kind? Are you patient? Are you impassioned? Do you lend your dishwasher money out of your pocket from paycheck to paycheck? What do you do? Like, who are you? And that's I aspire to be that kind of chef who gets the whole person who's working for me. You know, they're not just a pair of hands and a tool for my vision. I'm also trying to learn from them, and that's something I learned most from my father. My father was a lovely, lovely, warm man who had all these things attached to his name, PhD and blah, blah, blah. But at base, he just was a kind, generous man. That's what impresses me in a kitchen.
We'll be right back.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Chef Story, and today my guest is Katie Sparks, and we're sitting at Tavern on the Green, and in a beautiful, sunny summer morning, having coffee and listening to the birds, but listening to an extraordinary story. So, Katie, we've gone through your early days, and then your heyday when you were first discovered. And now we're sitting at one of the most iconic restaurants in New York City. Everyone has an expectation of this restaurant, from the people who got engaged here 40 years ago to the press who've never experienced it but have an opinion about it. And you have worked with people who took it from Warner Leroy's vision of a fantasy palace back to its original, not understated, I would say, but very, very sophisticated, classy, and respectful presence in one of the most beautiful parks in the world. So tell me about this, and what's your vision for the restaurant, and how is it a culmination of everything you've been telling us about?
Well, I agree with all that. I think it is really beautifully done, and I have to thank also the city and the Parks Department, because they had the overarching vision of bringing it back. And then Jim and David, who are the owners and friends of mine, they're both artists, and they just bring, you know, this unique visual celebration to the place without being, you know, over the top fanciful. So it dovetails well with my food, because I want my food to be celebratory, but I also want it to be sort of everyday-ish, meaning I'm not trying to dazzle or wow with plate presentations or we got a jet going.
I think we better take it. We can stop. I hope you're going someplace great.
Yeah.
You just interrupted our book. Okay, let's start.
Sure.
Again on what's your vision for this place?
My vision is just to essentially scale up everything I believe in. I really believe in, more and more as I educate myself more, sustainability. So that's a little bit beyond local, meaning I'm okay buying sustainably raised grass-fed beef if it's from Montana. It doesn't have to be from upstate New York, as long as the principles of sustainability are there. Very important to me. So here's a huge stage with a lot of buying power. You know, I'm buying, you know, millions and millions of dollars of product on an annualized basis. And I get to support businesses that I think are doing the right thing. And that's really, really a privilege. So I take that those great raw materials and just sort of offer them in a context of seasonal, regional, but also still my voice. I really feel like the best food is personal. So there's a personal touch to the food here. Even though we do 1,000 brunches and 800 dinners, you know, it's still me in there talking to my chefs and sous chefs and saying, what if we add a little bit more of this, or we balance it this way, or we take, you know, what if we caramelize this instead of just saute, you know, whatever it is, we labor over the details. And I'm really proud of that. I'm really proud of where we are at such a young age, being 2 months old. The critics have not been kind. In fact, you know, people set me up by saying I was the it girl of the 90s and then slam me to the ground. And it's been hard, but it's also been sort of galvanizing, you know. It's like, why be so impatient? Why slam us? I don't know the motivation. I'll never understand it. It's, you know, whatever. I'm a big girl, but still.
You know, I just want to point out to people, when Thomas Keller was at Raquel back in the 90s, he got slammed by the press, really slammed by the press. And so, you know, it takes a really a strong chef to retain his or her voice and keep your confidence. So it could be a great interview if we sat here and you got sparkling reviews. I don't think anybody's questioning your capability as a chef or your taste palate. To me, what's more interesting is, how do you withstand withering reviews, knowing all the money that went in this place, the passion of all the people behind this place, your absolute devotion to making your cuisine the best, and then all of a sudden the biggest newspaper in the world comes in, and it's like, you know, opening a Broadway show and having to do a different act for every single person sitting there. How do you, you're a big girl, you know, how do you take that? I think a lot of people out there would love to know the answer, because you are strong. You have a lot more, you know. I think this place, 6 months, you know, when, you know, it's like a football team, you know, especially at this size, you have a team of people, and you don't expect a football team to go out and win the Super Bowl the first year they get together, or even in the first month. And so I've always found it outrageous that restaurants are reviewed so early, before a team can really get into their groove. And, you know, and the critics will say, well, they're charging the price, so if they're going to charge the price. Yeah, well, you charge the price to go in and see an NFL game or a Mets game, you know, but when you're trying to put together the right team and there's a lot of money behind it, it really does take a while. And I, for a place like this, I think 6 months, a year is the right time to give it. So how are you withstanding these slings and arrows of the press?
Well, like any person, I have to rely on my people who love me and care about me, and my son, my wonderful partner in life, Tim, my ex-husband even has been incredible support, my good friends, my mom, my brother. I mean, these are all people I reach out to. I you know, it's tempting to turn inward and just curl up and be, you know, just wounded. But and there's definitely been some of that. I feel like just physically, my guts haven't been the same. You know, they'll recover, but it's, you know, it's ironic that I internalize stress right in my stomach. You know, so I haven't been eating well for a while. But it's hard, I think, but it's also an opportunity. You know, my son is 14, and I'm candid with him, and I share with him, and he's read the reviews, and I show him that, you know, it's hard, and it's on many levels, but on other levels, that testing that you were talking about still being who you are and still not losing your confidence. For me, if I can model that for him, then it's a gift. So I look at it that way. I'm not saying I don't know what the future holds. I really don't. I don't know. It's beyond my ability to control these variables, what people think. I know that we make a lot of friends every service period we're open. You know, the huge majority of people leave here feeling well-fed and having a good time and feeling that they understand and they're going to come back. So when you're doing that many covers a day, there's just exponential growth potential. So I understand also the business of writing about food. So they, whatever, that's their business. They need to be more outrageous than the critic before them to get more page views, whatever. That's fine. You guys go for it. But I just sort of divorce it from my reality as much as I can. Yes, it would have been much nicer to have approbation and affirmation. And yes, they're wonderful and they're doing great work and rah, rah. That would have felt great. But it didn't happen.
So my, prediction, and I've seen it before, I'm old, I've been in this profession almost 40 years, is, when you take a restaurant this size, and it, I don't want to say ambitious or overly ambitious, not, you actually cut it back, and it's incredibly beautiful and restrained, that I go back to that team analogy with sports. I don't think it's fair in the first 2 months to come in and expect this team to be singing, all right? And of course there are going to be missteps. And if a client is sitting there and doesn't like their plate, I am sure the server will take it back to the kitchen. And I think, this is a gorgeous place, and I think there will be a lot of people who will just, they don't listen to the press. They haven't read it. That's another thing. And 1 year from now, I think people are going to rediscover. And then they're going to say, well, she changed this and she did that. And probably you will. But my plea to everybody out there, including the journalist, is let's be fair. Let's be realistic. Maybe a small team with 6 people after 2 months can get it together. It's almost, they call it ballet in the kitchen. But you look at the size. How many employees, how many people in the kitchen, how many servers? What is it?
We are well over 200 employees, closer to 3, because we're full season now. So we're open all, we're 700 seats. A lot. I mean, just manning my line for one service, I have, 8 on the hotline, 3 in garmanger, 2 in pastry, just on the line. And then there's production chefs and, prep people and the stewarding staff that keeps everything clean and humming. And, there's 60 people. It's a lot. But, it's not, I don't know. All I can say is every day it gets more in line with our vision, but it's never been food that I wouldn't be happy sending out of the kitchen. It just might have been a little under seasoned or a little, like you said, if someone doesn't like it, the remedy is we'll do it again, or come back and try us when we're a little bit more seasoned, but it's never been something. I mean, the food quality is so high that I've never felt in any way uncomfortable serving dinners from day one.
I know, and some people will say, well, with Broadway or something, they have, they have tryouts off Broadway and things like that, or reduced prices. And in today's reality, in Manhattan, with the real estate prices, insurance, everything that you have to throw at this, you don't have that luxury. You're probably going to be working at a loss for a year or 2 years to get back the capital cost. And so the business reality of our business doesn't allow us to be, trying out in the Berkshires. You can't take your team up to the Berkshires. First of all, you don't have the New York diners up to do it, and it's not sourcing the vendors. So I'd really like to, maybe some of the people that are listening to this that are in power, influence in the press, we can have a healthy debate. I would love to see when is it appropriate and how is it appropriate to test a restaurant. And if the restaurant isn't making it in the first few weeks, don't you think that the diners won't come back?
That's the remedy that people forget. The remedy is, and this is what's a little shocking to me, having last been reviewed in the late 90s, the I guess snark is a word, but people people are feel free to say anything, no matter how mean-spirited and ugly. It's like, wow, when did that happen? It's just sort of just not couth. It's uncouth.
Yeah.
And it's uncool. And yet that's where we are. You know, my mother is like scandalized. She's, you know, old school, you know, Greenbrier girl. But it's funny that to me, the quest for being heard or seen in print or whatever your medium is, I think tips people over a little bit into the, they just need to be more reasonable and fair, as you were pointing out. And everyone in my industry complains about the same thing. There's no time to get up to speed. You're judged immediately. Yelp is filled with angry people. And like, I would love to be part of the conversation around returning to some civility, because it's just nicer. It's a nicer environment in which to live, whether you're a chef or whomever you are, whatever you're doing.
I agree. I think I want to come back in a year and we're going to talk again.
Okay.
And I think this is a really hot topic because you are one sensational chef. You have proven yourself to the world. And this is a huge challenge for any chef that would take on 700 seats in the middle of New York in a landmark. And I know you're going to make it. So thanks for being with me today. And do you have any last words of wisdom for our listeners out there? And I'm always thinking of the young chefs who want to be the next Katie Sparks.
Well, I would say that they should really listen to your show because, I mean, the questions you ask, the background that you bring, I think is invaluable. So just keep listening to Dorothy's show. It's really lovely. And the freedom to really express myself is all I could ever ask for, both in food and in words. So I thank you very much.
Well, thank you for that. I wasn't looking for that. But I want to thank Robin Cohen, who helps me so much on this show, and Jack Inslee over at Heritage Radio. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.